Thank you, and hi, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I really am grateful to be here this afternoon. We always get up and say that, but I really do mean it. There are lots of reasons, and one of them is I love to come to Virginia, and you folks just must like to punish yourselves or something, because I really believe that at these events over here, there are more people that I know well and love than there are at the average meeting at my home in Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm just glad to see all of you, and especially those of you that I know and care about. Thank you. And thank you, Billy, for putting it together, and all of you that were involved with that. And as always, the hospitality in Virginia is the greatest anywhere. So thank you so much. And Allison, thank you for a great talk this morning, and Billy Boy. Now, both of you have kind of mimicked me. I don't know whether I can follow the act or not. The genuine article may not have quite the pizzazz of the mimicry. And by the way, Billy told me to tell you that he did forget one of his most important lines, and I'm going to convey it to you for him. Billy says to let you know that he may not be much, but he's always on his mind. And I think that kind of sums up a lot of us. And well, what I need to do, if I can get some divine intervention, is to let God get me out of the way and try to follow directions. Because if I try to give you a talk and it comes out of my head, we're going to wind up with a mess, folks. So I don't want to do that. I want to try to talk a little bit by following the directions of talking about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And another set of directions that I really love that we don't talk about as much. The book says that our personal story is telling our own language and from our own point of view, how we've been able to form a relationship with our God. And I hope my story carries that, because when I was first exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was absolutely allergic to the God thing. I'm not talking about just closed. I was allergic. And anytime you guys would mention God, it would insult my intelligence, and the little hairs would stand up on the back of my neck. And when you talked about higher power, you weren't fooling me. You were trying to backdoor me on the God crap. I think that made me even madder. And so the talk about God and higher power kept running me out the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of the ones that's so blessed, because I was able to live long enough to keep getting run back in here by alcohol, because I didn't have anywhere else to go. Until finally the miracle happened, and I was able to take the hand that you guys had been holding out to me for a long time. And I was able to let you lead me through these 12 steps that, as far as I know, are the only program of recovery we have. In fact, as far as I know, those 12 steps are the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the only program that I know of is those 12 steps. And in leading me through those steps led me to a loving God that I didn't even know was there for me. And that, folks, is the only reason that I'm standing here on this beautiful day in this beautiful Virginia country talking to you beautiful people instead of having been rotting in a pauper's grave for over 27 years. And I'm not guessing at that. I know it to be an absolute fact. So I hope my story carries that. As far as following the directions, those of you, many of you have heard me talk before, and you know the problem I've had with the directions. They don't apply to me because my case is different, you know, without divine intervention. And, of course, I've always known who makes the directions. Square Johns make the directions, and they're usually being advised by liability lawyers who are worse than they are, for God's sake. And I know what the purpose of the directions is. It's to manipulate stone idiots into doing things. So obviously they always overstate it. And in a special case like myself, you sort of have to extrapolate in order to figure out what the directions really mean. And I assure you that that does not cause me a problem, nor am I normally aware of it. Without divine intervention, it'll just happen. If I look at something that says, for instance, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, without divine intervention, my brain will register that as really meaning something like do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. The good news about all this divine intervention I need, by the way, is I found out it's pretty easy to get when I'm willing to stay close to you guys and when I'm willing to do the work and the steps and try to stay close to my God. I found out it's pretty easy to get. And before I forget it, my sobriety date is April the 9th of 1981. And my home group is the Calm Down Group across the river from downtown Louisville, Kentucky. And I named that group, by the way, many years ago. And, you know, my alcoholism is many, many things. And the book says that selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of our troubles. And the way that was explained to me early on is that the first thing wrong with me, the thing that's wrong before anything else, before any mental obsession with alcohol, before the physical allergy became a factor, before any of the mental, physical, spiritual, emotional illnesses that come with it, the very first thing wrong with me is I've got a disorder of my ego. And Allison talked about it, and Billy talked about it. We all describe it in different words. But what it is with me is that without divine intervention, all my life I've been so obsessed with myself. I've been so obsessed with how I feel. In fact, the last few years I've tended to boil the basis of my alcoholism down to one sentence. Without divine intervention, I will always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the world to me. Now, without divine intervention, I can give lip service to other things being more important. Without divine intervention, sometimes for a little while, I can even act like something is more important than the way I feel. But without divine intervention, that's all a smokescreen. When the chips get down, I'm going to let how I feel be the most important thing in this world to me. And I've always been obsessed with comparing myself to other people in this world. That ego disorder makes me an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I've always been capable of feeling too good for something or somebody, and at the same time knowing I wasn't nearly good enough for that same thing or that same person. I've always known that I could do anything. At the same time, I've always known that I couldn't really do anything. And all that obsession with myself has had the only result that I think it can have in a human being. It creates so much pain and so much emptiness down inside me that I've never been able to stand the way I feel inside without either running as hard as I can and or stuffing something in there to try to make myself feel good enough that I can stand it. And that's really the way I made it through the first 12 or 13 years of my life. 25 years ago in telling my story, I probably was still telling quite an interesting and romantic tale of my early life and subsequent rise to power. and, of course, it was all about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reached in life. And I believed that crap so sincerely, I would usually have you and me both crying before I was halfway done with it. And I wasn't sober a week before I realized it was total crap. We weren't even poor. We weren't anywhere close to poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and most of the things that we wanted. And the heights were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. My alcoholism is many things, and one thing that it is, it's a disease of superlatives. And what that means is that without divine intervention, I won't ever think in terms of things like good and bad, and ordinary will never cross my mind. I think in terms of best, worst, just the absolute extremes of everything. So the real truth is, both drunk and sober, I've probably been a whole lot more plain old garden variety ordinary than my ego's ever been able to stand. But rather than all, and by the way, that self-delusion is totally intact. It is unscathed by almost 28 years a day at a time of not drinking and going to meetings and working the steps. Without divine intervention, my capacity for self-delusion is totally intact. It's just as healthy as it ever was. So what really happened the first 12 or 13 years of my life, instead of all that interesting romantic crap, was a little kid so uncomfortable inside I couldn't stand it, trying to keep all the bells ringing and the lights flashing and the smoke shooting out to keep you from seeing what I was and what I wasn't, so that I wouldn't have to stop and look at it, because a part of me knew that somehow if I did have to stop and look at what I was and what I wasn't inside, that it would be like the earth would swallow me up through that emptiness in my own middle. So I tried to stay a half step ahead of a screaming fit. On account of that ego disorder, it had a lot of other effects on me. I believe the problem with God and the higher power was a result of that. My religious friends today tell me that a personal God is something that's more important to us than anything else in the conducting and unfolding of every minute of every hour of every day of our life. I believe that the idea that something was more important than my little old brain as far as actually conducting my life was totally unacceptable to my ego, and it was just absolutely vetoed that we cannot, will not consider even that there's anything more important than our brain as far as running my life. I also believe that on account of that ego disorder that I didn't have any teachability or humility at all until I got sober. And I was 37 when I got sober. The reason I don't believe I had any teachability or humility is that I've never been able to remember a single time in that first 37 years that I voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life, unless I understood it and I agreed with it and I thought it would work. And, you know, every time I say that, something in the back of my mind says, what's wrong with that? Well, when I get honest about it, it's real simple. I've got a talking illness. My alcoholism has been running its mouth at me all my life. And my alcoholism talking to me is a terrifying thing. And what's so terrifying about it is this. Oddly, I've nearly died from alcoholism dozens of times. I'll probably breeze past a little bit of that in a few minutes. But what's so scary is I'm absolutely convinced that my alcoholism has never tried to kill me, because it doesn't care whether I live or die. And my alcoholism doesn't care whether you live or die. My alcoholism is the perfect sociopath. It's only got one reason for existing. And that's try to get itself that next drink. And it'll tell me anything on the face of this earth in order to get it. It'll tell me something that might kill you, me, or both of us. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another without ever dropping a stitch. It doesn't care. It just slings it all up against the wall and hopes some of it will stick. Well, I got to tell you, that old crazy picture show that I'm describing rolling in the back of my head has not gone away in nearly 28 years sober. What my recovery has been, it has not been that my alcoholism doesn't talk to me. And by the way, my alcoholism talking to me and my brain talking to me without divine intervention are one and the same thing, because I've got an alcoholic brain. And without divine intervention, there's no difference in my illness talking to me and my brain talking to me. What my recovery has been is that most of the time I can recognize that that's not reality and I can go ahead and try to do the next right thing anyway. But the important phrase there is most of the time. Because you see, another head on this hydra that my alcoholism is, sometimes I call it a mini-splendored thing, because it's every fiber of my being. I don't believe there's any story of Don Major other than the story of alcoholism and the recovery from it. And I mean that absolutely. I think there's simply no story. And if my alcoholism is anything at all, it's a disorder of my perception. And, of course, what that literally means is I don't always see things right. I don't always hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. So the bottom line is real simple. When I put the final veto in the universe in my little old brain, that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it and I agree with it and I think it'll work. And that's what it is. That's making my brain the final veto in the universe. With what I've got wrong with me, I have just put myself under death sentence. Because, you see, on account of my disorder of my perception, I'll wind up believing one of those deadly lies that my alcoholism's telling me. And I'll pick up that drink and I'll die that mad dog death and I'll wind up in that grave. That was the mess I brought to my first drunk when I was 12 or 13. I grew up on a tobacco farm down in southwestern Kentucky. And I got drunk the first time at 12 or 13. I got in a lot of trouble and I puked, blacked out, passed out, woke up next morning, had a terrible hangover. And I swore all those Baptists around there were right and I would never, ever do it again. And I couldn't have been more sincere, and actually it was fairly effective because it was nearly a week until I got drunk the second time. And the way things were going to go for the next 25 years, that was a near miracle. And, of course, the reason I got drunk second time is the same reason I got drunk the 2,000th time and all the times in between. It's because when the first time that I got enough of that stuff in me, for the first time in my life, something did something about that pain and that emptiness that obsession with myself has created all my life. And for the first time in my life, I felt good enough inside that I could stand the way I felt without running or trying to stuff anything else in there. Now, both Billy and Allison have described this morning a very similar thing. Not all alcoholics have it, but I do. And by the way, I didn't jump up and say the magic had happened. I didn't realize that was magic until I got sober a quarter of a century later. At the time, all I knew was that for a few minutes, on my way to puking and so on, I had passed through a right pleasant neighborhood. But looking back on it, of course it was magic. And what makes it magic is that simple bottom line, that how I feel is the most important thing in the universe to me. And since that was the booze and later on the things like it were the only things that ever made me feel that way, to me, my powerlessness over alcohol is a no-brainer. It couldn't have been any other way. Because when I wanted to change the way I felt, and that's the most important thing in the world, bottom line, simple, it didn't matter what it cost. And it didn't matter who it cost. Because it was the only game in town for me. From that first drunk till the time I got sober, alcohol dominated everything. I'm not going to spend much time on a drunk log. But I do want to let you all know that I didn't just wake up one morning and think my spiritual condition might improve if I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. during that 25 years, I'm very sure that I went to bed legally drunk at least 80% of the nights. I did not know that I was going to bed drunk that much because the only standard or measurement for drunk I ever had was whether or not I blacked out. If I remembered everything, that case was closed and that discussion was over. I was not drunk. Truth is, now that Kentucky's got that legal limit down to .08, I probably woke up drunk 80% of the mornings. We all have different stories, and it's really easy for we alcoholics are at least as good at bragging about how bad we are or were as we are about bragging about how great we are, and we're pretty good at that from time to time. But truly and honestly, in my story of drinking, just my own personal story, I never apologized for it. I never hid it. To the best of my memory, I never told myself or anybody else one time in my life that I was just going to have a couple of drinks. I never wanted a couple of drinks. A couple of drinks never did anything to me except make me need something to drink real bad. Again, Allison referred to this morning in different words about friends leaving when they question the drinking song. The way I put that is that really I think for the last 20 years that I drank, I didn't have people in my life. I had positions. And whatever your position was, I probably had your replacement interviewed at any given time. And I'm not proud of that. I think that's a pretty good partial description of a sociopath. But it was based on this. I knew by the time I was in my mid-teens that if anybody stayed close enough to me long enough, and I'm not just talking about intimate relationships, I'm talking about the paper boy if we had enough conversation with one another. If anybody stayed close enough to me long enough, they would wind up blowing the whistle on my drinking and saying something like, wait a minute, Don, you know, you're a nice guy most of the time, and it gets real exciting being around you sometimes. But there's something wrong here. There's something wrong with the way you drink. There's something wrong with the way you live, and we need to talk about that. We need to look at that. Now, what I would usually say was, my God, what a relief. I'm so glad you brought that up. We do need to talk about it. What was really going on was, if I couldn't change your mind, your ticket was punched. You were out of my life. It didn't make any difference how much another part of me needed you, cared about you, or loved you as best I could. If you were going to interfere with the only thing that made me feel the way I needed to feel, and how I feel is the most important thing in the universe, I couldn't have you in my life. By the time I was 16, and school was always really easy for me, and by the time I was 16 and a junior in high school, things were getting ready to start unraveling. Now, the 1950s in Trigg County, Kentucky, were a different world in a lot of ways from our world today. In the 1950s in Trigg County, Kentucky, if you were cute enough, smart enough, and had the right last name, you could get away with murder. In today's environment, they would have thrown a net over my butt by the time I was 14 years old. But I was able to just get by with everything and keep rolling. And I was 16 and a junior in high school. And part of me knew that things were about to start crumbling, that it was time to get out of Dodge. And the egomania part knew that that tobacco farm couldn't handle something as hot as I was. So I walked out of a tobacco field and got on a Greyhound bus by myself and went 200 miles up to the big city of Louisville there in Kentucky. And I kicked around for two or three days, and I wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville. In fact, it was kind of funny. Yesterday morning before we left Louisville, I talked to the law students about substance abuse, and I was able to tell them that I was in that administration building right out the window there. And the dean of men up there interviewed me, and they wound up giving me two or three days of test, and they let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. And my reaction to that was, the first semester I stayed so drunk that I lost all concept of day and night. It was just a matter of passing out and coming to. And, of course, I blew the scholarship. And then for the next 7.5 years, I worked full-time, drank full-time, went to school full-time, and somehow finished undergraduate in law school, and don't have a clue how that happened. When I look back on that whole 8 years, I don't have a handful of concrete memories even of the whole 8 years. And it just feels like a whirling gray mass of alcoholic insanity. Well, spring of 1968, I graduated from law school. And my daughter, who was my only child for over 20 years, I have a 20-year-old son now, but my daughter Dana, who some of you folks have met, was born 41 years ago today. It's her birthday. And so I started practicing law in downtown Louisville, and I practiced for about 10 years with really a good deal of material success, not nearly as much as I used to think I had had. You know, it's odd how as we stay sober longer, we get a different focus on the past. But I've always been a criminal defense lawyer, and I've always had a knack for getting involved in cases that had some money in them and some publicity value in them. And that's what I would stick in your face when you suggested there was something wrong with somebody who lived as insanely as I did. And as insanely as I lived up to 1968 when I got out of law school, it accelerated considerably after I got started practicing law. One reason, I'm sure, is just a natural progression of alcoholism. Another big reason, I'm sure, is because I had some money to get really crazy with. During that 10 years from 68 to 1978, the first 10 years I practiced law, I honestly believe that at least a third of the nights I didn't make any attempt to take off my clothes and go to bed like a normal human being. I either passed out in some circumstance other than that, or I changed the variety of what I was putting in my body and just went, tried to keep flying on through without laying my head down. During that 10 years, I began to use a lot of things other than the booze. But during that 10 years, just exactly like they were with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, all those other things were sideshows to the booze. The booze was the big tent. All the other things were things to change the effect of the booze, increase the effect, decrease the effect, help me try to function on the hangovers. But the booze was the main focus. February 10th of 1978, I got full of scotch, cocaine, quaaludes, speed, and vodka. I'd been practicing law 10 years. I was still holding on to the material things by my fingernails. I was remarried to my daughter's mother. And as far as I'm concerned, the fact that I was remarried to my daughter's mother establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. Now, that's not because there's anything particularly wrong with my daughter's mama. It's because in the years I've been sober, I just kind of looked around and checked it out, and I swear I don't believe in the history of the world anybody but us ever did that. I believe that if a normie even considered jumping right back in a frying pan that they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum, getting them to try to protect themselves. And we do it routinely, drunk and sober. And the bizarre thing is it works for us sometimes. It's not even bad. It's just really different from normal people now. Now, that's hopefully my sole sociological observation of the afternoon. It's not in the big book. Feel free to ignore it. But at any rate, I was remarried to my daughter's mother at that time. The lady I had with me was not my daughter's mother. I drove a Corvette off the road at about 130 miles an hour. I did an awful lot of bad things to my body, broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg, had to do a bypass in the upper leg, take out a vein, graft it in to replace the artery. Separated my pelvis and pulled my plumbing in two, so I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had a suprapubic catheter, they call it. It was just a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in the abdomen, pop that into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. And I had a half dozen major surgeries the first year after that wreck and was in the hospital more than 6 months of that year. The doctors told me early on that I would never walk again without braces on at least one, maybe two legs, and maybe a cane or two. And they assured me that there was no chance that a surgeon anywhere would ever attempt to find the ends of my plumbing and put them together so I would ever pee again. Just for the record, and purely by the grace of God, because we know it wasn't me following directions. We've already talked about me and the directions. If I make it 5 more days, I'll have been sober 28 years and haven't owned a brace or a cane for over 29 years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did put my plumbing back together and restore my urinary function. But I didn't know that was going to happen. And my reaction to that prognosis after I got out of intensive care was that every single day my friends came into those hospitals for months and brought me booze every single day and more dope than the doctors were giving me. And I would lay in that hospital bed and say really intelligent things. Like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough. But it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. And then I'd explain to him that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he's not prepared to do the time. And just because we'd hit a little bump in the road, they weren't going to hear me whining. Give me another drink and let's go on with it. That's real insanity. That's real powerlessness. And it is truly letting the way I feel right at the instant be the most important thing in the world to me. More important than my child. More important than my family. More important than my profession. More important than my health. Really more important than whether I lived or died. Letting how I feel at the instant be the most important thing in the world to me. My daughter's mother, of course, re-divorced me right after the wreck on account of the circumstances, and I wound up married to the young lady during that period who was with me. She was hurt, but not nearly as badly as I was. She had on a seatbelt, for God's sake, and it didn't go broke right away. A little law firm had built up around this other guy and myself, so some money kept coming in, not as much as it had been, but some, about a year after that wreck, sometime around the first year of 1979, I made my first trip to the asylum, and Billy was joking with the other Billy and me when we got here this morning. We had spent last night in Stanton on the way over here, and he was going to introduce us as direct from Stanton. We didn't realize that was the traditional home of the asylum here. But I don't use the word asylum to be funny or cute. Bill Wilson uses that word, and my mama used that word. When I was a kid, they didn't talk about people having breakdowns and going to the hospital. They talked about people going crazy and being put in asylums, and that's far more descriptive of what kept happening to me, let me assure you. And by the time I got to that asylum, I still had the tube in the belly and the catheter bag and the braces and the crutches. And the phenomenon of craving that the doctor's opinion talks about, and all the world that is the physical addiction to ethyl alcohol. And if you ever felt that sucker, you know what it is, because it wound up being the most powerful physical force I've ever felt in my life. You look at a fellow who's had like 13 or 14 major surgeries, and I've never felt anything physical like the last couple hundred times I checked on my craving for ethyl alcohol once I get some in my body. And by that time, that had progressed to the point where once I started drinking, I just pretty well physically lost the ability to stop. Something had to intervene and get me prized loose from alcohol. And when it did that, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to do something like sit up in a chair. Well, they got me in that asylum. They got me through the 3 or 4 days, and they set me up in a chair and had an AA meeting for some strange reason. And somebody got them red steps. They got step 3, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Well, that insulted my intelligence. So I climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And then I hobbled on over the telephone, we didn't have cell phones then, and called somebody to get me away from the religious fanatics before they polluted my pristine intellect. Now, that was sometime around the first year of 79. I got sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81, and I really don't remember much of that. But some things that I do know happened during that period are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a needle street junkie. And I'm really grateful for that, because that brought enough pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I had founded. And I proved that I wasn't going to make the decision that is bottom. And don't kid yourself. Bottom's not an accident. A lot of times there may not even be a whole lot of grace involved in it. Bottom's a decision. It's a decision over which we've got control. Alcoholism doesn't have, if you look at it as an elevator, it doesn't have but one destination. It's the basement. That's where that sucker's going. But any time we will take our own hand and reach our own finger out, and we will push the button. Because, you see, I found out that you guys couldn't push the button for me, and God wouldn't. Any time we will push that button and say, "All right, I'll do anything to keep from feeling the way I've been feeling and living the way I've been living," we can get off at any floor. But bottom line, I was not willing at that time to make that decision as long as I had a Timex watch. I certainly wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. Right after the guys kicked me out of the law firm, the state of Kentucky jerked my law license. My new wife had to leave me on account of my insanity. And during that period, she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident. I last laid eyes on Dana, the young woman I wished a happy 41st birthday this morning, in January of 1980. And I didn't see or talk to Dana again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my portion of the office building we'd built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things like that. The mortgage companies took the homes the ex-wives were in, and it was just all gone. And for around a year up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address. I lived on what I called the street and an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. And by the way, to this day, I have never met anybody who knew me during that period who thought there was any hope that I would live. And that includes a number of people that were already in recovery at that time. In fact, back, I hadn't told this for years. I don't know whether I've ever told it in Virginia, and I'm going to tell this. Cherry Carpenter was my original sponsor in Nashville, Tennessee, and Cherry means so much to me. Cherry died in late 1989, I believe it was. I didn't find this out until Cherry had been dead 3 or 4 years. And I was speaking at a convention down in Gulf Shores, Alabama, and we extended it, took a little vacation. I went to a discussion meeting. And I ran into a fellow down there that I had known when I'd gotten sober in Nashville, who had hung around there. In fact, he'd wound up married for a while, a gal I dated down there, and he'd been a lawyer himself. Really, he's dead now. His name was Jim Porter. And Jim wound up, when he finally did get sober, a couple of years after I left Nashville, getting Cherry to be his sponsor. Now, I'm sitting in this discussion meeting, and Jim's saying, you know, out loud in the meeting, how happy he is to see me. And he says, yeah, after all the relapses I'd had, I finally went to Cherry Carpenter there in Nashville. I said, Cherry, I don't think I can get this thing to work. I've just got too much ego, and I'm too self-centered, and I don't believe it'll work for me. And Jim said, and Cherry just looked at me, and he said, Jim, if this thing will work for Don Major, it'll work for anybody in the world. And I've never known whether Cherry was insulting me or complimenting me. But anyway, I don't know why I went off on that track, but I did. But at any rate, I washed up on the doorstep of Asylum Number 17 in the fall of 1980, and that was in Nashville, Tennessee. They told me later that they only let me in because they didn't think I'd live a week if they left me on the street. Of course, I had no home, no car, no clothes. My teeth were rotting out of my head. Stayed in there a month, had no place to go when it was time to be booted out. I had a roommate in there who was a younger fella, and his family lived in Nashville. And those wonderful people felt sorry for me. And they're not really even involved in AA. You know, we stay sober a while, and we develop this sort of vague idea that spirituality is peculiar to alcoholics. I know sometimes with my wife, who the fact is, Sharon wakes up more spiritual every morning than I can get after 3 meetings and 2 hours of prayer and 2 inventories a day. But I have to catch myself sometimes from saying to Sharon, well, my God, honey, what do you know about spirituality? You're not even an alcoholic. The truth is, I hate to tell you all this, don't want to insult anybody, but in 1935, or 34 really, God took pity on a bunch of spiritual retardees. And through Bill Wilson, he gave us a dose of spirituality that is so simple that even we can grab hold of a little corner of this wonderful spirituality that people have been enjoying for millennia. So we don't have a monopoly on spirituality, guys. But at any rate, these wonderful people said, Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days and let's try to figure out what to do with you. So I went and lived with them a year. The first 6 months I didn't stay straight, but it got better. And by the way, in the last 3 months I've had an opportunity to see and be with them 3 times, even though they moved to Florida and do some things to help them. It's just so wonderful to be able to pay that back. I'm speaking down in Florida the 1st of May and plan to see them again. But the first 6 months I lived with them from the fall of 1980 until April of 81, I didn't stay straight, but I got better. And I believe I needed to get better. And I don't know that it's in the big book, but I think I was too far gone to grasp recovery or anything else without some improvement. After I was sober 2 to 3 months, I remember night after night we would go to a meeting there at the 202 Club in Nashville on West End Avenue, or right off West End, and then we would go up the street to the Shoney's, and I would sit there with a knife and fork under the table, watching my friends use a knife and fork on food because I had simply lost the capacity to do that. It wasn't a matter of forgetting. It was just simply gone. And I think I was just embarrassed to say, excuse me, Jimmy P., will you show me how to use this knife and fork? I seem to have lost that somewhere. But anyway, I think I needed to get better. And during that 6 months, fall of 80 to the spring of 81, I did get better. I went to a world of AA meetings, most of them at that clubhouse that I mentioned, the 202 Club there in Nashville. I got to where I could go as long as 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped. And that was a world record for me in or out of the asylum. I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum. And how I really know I got better is that in that whole 6-month period, they only put me in a rubber room 1 time. At the rate I'd been going, twice a year in the asylum looked like the picture of mental health. And late March of 81, I got on my most recent drunk, and it was another one of my pop-off vodka / Listerine drunks. And I truly have drunk a barrel of both those things. And I have better memories of the Listerine I can stand the smell of Listerine today, but I can't stand the smell of old Pop-Off. But on this most recent drunk, I was drinking and taking everything I could find. And by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks. I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville, 11. God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. Now, for the first few weeks I was sober, I had no idea that I had any gifts or that there was any such thing as loving God. And for anybody that's new, this is really important to me. I didn't feel any different coming off that last drunk than I had the 200 before it. I didn't feel any less too special. I didn't feel any less too bad. I didn't have any less pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I didn't have any less mental roadblock against believing in God or higher power. I hadn't changed my mind about a thing, as far as I could tell. If I had kept waiting until my mind and my feelings changed before I started blindly doing what you guys and that big book told me to do, I would have been rotting in that pauper's grave for over 27 years. The biggest gift my loving God had given me was the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to do some things that were suggested even though I didn't understand them. I didn't agree with them. I didn't think they would work, and I certainly didn't want to do them. And as I say, I had no idea I had that. So with 3 or 4 days after that last drink, I stumbled back to the door of the clubhouse there in Nashville, 202, and I didn't think they would let me in. And they should not have let me in, really. I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out. And they had caught me shooting dope in the men's room. They had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through that clubhouse and a big old boy about 6'6", Joe Wall, Joe's dead now, walked up and looked way down at me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." And I thought he was giving me a compliment. My knee-jerk reaction was, well, thank God they have finally figured out who they're dealing with here. But he went on, and he said, "And you know, Don, that's a real shame, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all time." And that felt like an icy hand closing over something inside me, and it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to the door, and they did let me in. I remember exactly what was said and who said it. They said, "Yeah, come on in, Don. You're keeping us sober." And I said, "Well, y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live." And they said, "Sure. Don't drink, don't take dope, and go to meetings." By the grace of God, the first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, I clearly remember that during those 60 days, it was obvious to me that I was going to way too many of the fool meetings. It was clear that it was doing little, if any, good. It was still obvious you all were religious fanatics. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, big car, good-looking woman, be somebody, for God's sake. But I had been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had of being able to turn around to my brain and say, "Yeah, I know, partner, but you and I have nearly killed one another. And we don't have anything left to do but go to these dumb old meetings, even though they can't possibly solve our unique problems." And the great news is that those meetings worked just as well as if I had thought, felt, and believed they were exactly what I needed. You see, just like always, and without divine intervention, I'll make this same mistake in every area of my life. I'll make it all about what I think, feel, and believe. You know, if I don't want to do the right thing, without divine intervention, what I want to do is fix me so I feel like doing the right thing. You know, if I wake up and don't feel like going to work, without divine intervention, I want to call Billy and say, "Billy, I don't feel like going to work. What can we do to make me feel like going to work?" Well, I got some bad news for you guys, if you're alcoholics like me at all. In the years that I've been sober, I have prayed to God untold hours for God to fix me inside so I would feel like doing right, so I could do right. I have worried sponsors to distraction, talking to them about what we needed to do to fix me inside so I would feel like doing right, so I could do right. I've done enough inventories that I bet they'd stack up 2 feet if we had them all up here on the floor. After I got a little money, I spent quite a bit of money on outside counseling, going to get me fixed inside so I'd feel like doing right, so I could do right. And here's the bad news. Not one single time in all those years has anything made me feel like doing right except going on and doing right when I don't feel like it. And that is more maturity than I can nearly stand. It's just awful news. But at any rate, thank God, all I needed to do, I had it backwards. I didn't need to think, feel, believe anything. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting and let my old sick brain and soul get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind that raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to read the big book. And I said, I've read it several times. And they said, we know. You've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying. They said, you've got in your head this book some sort of philosophy book. That there's something there you can study or learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety. They said, partner, forget it. They said, in the first place, don't buy this crap about recovery being a learning process. They said, you got to learn about that much. And they said, Don, in your case, you have had enough information about recovery for over 2 years to stay sober a day at a time the rest of your life without ever learning one single new piece of information about recovery. They said, what's killing you is not what you know and don't know, it's what you're doing and not doing, dummy. And they said, what this book truly is a simple instruction manual for your actions. And what recovery is a doing process. It doesn't make any difference what's going through your mind. So they said, if you want to live, you better come back to this book like a little child. And start at the front cover, trying to act like you've never seen it before. And go through it line for line, reading only the black part. Not interpreting, memorizing, or arguing with anything. Not looking for anything to learn, but look at what it says do. That's when they explain that the steps are the only program of recovery. The steps are the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They explain the difference between the fellowship, which is what we're doing right today. It's what we do when we go to meetings. It's what we do when we socialize with one another. And it's wonderful and it's necessary. And we can be a member of the fellowship on any day we've got a desire to stop drinking. There's no other requirement. But unless we are somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9, the way the book says do them, or having done that, we're doing the action that every day is living on 10, 11, and 12. So we'll do that action that is the maintenance of our spiritual condition and get our daily reprieve. If we're not somewhere in that process, we are not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're just in the fellowship. And we're not in a program of recovery. And if we won't get any healing at all with what's really wrong, of that ego disorder, of that inability to be comfortable inside ourselves, of letting how we feel be the most important thing in the universe. The only healing that we'll get through the steps. They explained at that time that the steps work on, are the prescription for alcoholism. That they work on alcoholism the way penicillin works on an infection. You know, if I've got an infection, it isn't necessary for me to understand the whys and wherefores of my infection and where I got it. I don't need to go to the library and read up on that. I don't need to worry my friend's death talking about it. I don't need to understand a single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. I don't even need to believe that that silly little bottle of pills can take care of all these terrible things wrong with wonderful me. And here's the real kicker. I don't need to want to take the pills. If I've got the infection and I take the pills as directed, I'll get just fine. Thank you. And they explain that these steps work on alcoholism exactly the same way. They're not there for me to discuss and understand and agree with. They're there for me to do if I want to live with it comfortably with this thing called alcoholism. Then they tell me before I live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and every night and ask and thank a power greater than myself. The tears streamed down my cheeks, truly. And I said, that's it. That's what's killing me. I really have tried, and I had, at that time, for 2.5 years. Because I knew I was dying of alcoholism. I had zero denial about it. And it was obvious to me that the only shot I had of living was to somehow change myself into being more like you guys and less like me. And I explained to him that I'd spent 2.5 years trying to change myself. And changing myself for me always goes back to that fatal error. I'm always talking about what I think, feel, and believe. I thought that that was the change that had to be made. And I'm tearfully telling them that I can't change any of it. And they said, Don, son, you have got that backwards too. They said, we have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. My mouth probably fell open, since to me that's the center of the universe, what I think, feel, and believe. And they went on to say, well, no, Don, we would never do that. Son, you are far too ill to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs whatsoever. Said, if we were dependent on that for your recovery, you're dead. they said, and also your thoughts, feelings, beliefs are your illness. They're one and the same thing. And he said, the issue of whether you live or die will be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, or believe won't have one thing to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, you get down on your knees and you start saying those words every morning and every night. And we don't care what's going through your head because that won't count. And having no idea that I had the gift that I had, not knowing why I was doing it, over my brain's loud veto, sometime in April 1981, I started getting on my knees every morning and every night, 100% acting as if, knowing that it couldn't work, knowing that there was nothing there hearing those prayers. And somewhere along the line, the miracle of the second step began to happen, and I began to come to believe. Then they led me through the third step. Finally got it through my head that that was only a decision, and what the decision was to do the rest of the steps and try to do the next right thing instead of what I wanted to do when they conflicted. Led me through my fourth and fifth step. I formed a picture of what a spiritual Don ought to look like. Went home after doing my fifth step, spent an hour doing step 6 and 7, like that half page in the book tells us to do. Thought 6 and 7 were where, with God's help, I went to work on me, to make me into what I had decided spiritual Don ought to be like when I did my fourth, fifth step. In the process of doing steps 8 and 9, my law license got put back in order, and in January of 1983, 21 months sober, I went back to Louisville, scared to death, didn't want to go. If I could have gotten a job in Nashville at a convenience store, I would not have gone back to Louisville to practice law, and that's not an exaggeration. I was terrified to go back up there, and from 27 years in the future, I don't think it was paranoia. I think there were really good reasons for me not to go back to Louisville. I believe a loving God poured oil on the troubled waters of my past to make it work out. And I didn't like Louisville AA. I knew it wasn't going to be any good, but I didn't have any choice, so I threw myself into those dumb old Louisville AA meetings, and it wasn't a month before I thought Louisville AA was probably better than Nashville. The second month I was in town, February of 83, a speaker got snowed in somewhere out west. They were having the Kentucky State Convention with 2,000 people there. And somebody said, let's put that clown up there, 21 months sober. So he stuck me up there to talk to 2,000 people. And a lot of miracles started happening. People started asking me to be their sponsor and to travel here and there and to talk and do this. That same month, February of 83, I saw Dana for the first time in over 3 years. 2 months later, she moved in with me, and she lived with me all through her high school years, and she and I are dear friends now, and she's been in Al now over 20 years. Started making some money. First thing you know, I'm driving a decent car, and I'm wearing decent clothes now. But mind you, the financial thing did not straighten out easily. When I was 3.5 years sober in October of 1984, I got on a conference call with my sponsor, Cherry, and my lawyer, Joe Golden, Billy. And we had a conference call and decided that in 3.5 years sober, my financial circumstances had improved to the point where I could file bankruptcy without getting indicted. It took 3.5 years sober to work up to being able to file a Chapter 11 bankruptcy with a plan to pay back 100 cents on the dollar. My credibility was so great that the creditors litigated it for 4 years before they would let us implement a plan to pay 100 cents on the dollar. So finally we did that in April of 1996, the month I was 15 years sober. I made the last payment on the financial wreckage of my past. But I learned a great thing. And any of you that are there and you're around step 8 and 9, You don't have to get those things paid off to be free and to feel good. As soon as you start sending those $5 or $10 checks readily, as soon as you stop hiding from those people and let them know, you will always know where I am. As soon as you start doing that, you have the freedom. I didn't feel any great relief in April 1996 when I made that last payment because I'd been free for years because of that. So don't think you have to wait until it's all taken care of. You know, we've all got this idea, every alcoholic I've met has an idea down deep inside them that the way financial amends are going to be made is you bring in all the money plus 25% juice and cash, throw it on the desk in a paper sack, and say, there's your dang money. That ain't the way it happens. It happens with those $5 and $10 checks every week. Every week. The checks are so small they couldn't possibly make any difference, but keeping on doing it, keeping on doing it. But at any rate, things were pretty good. In fact, the first 9 years of my sobriety were in many ways just enchanted. They were wonderful. From a fellow that everybody knew was going to die, I'm back, I'm practicing law, people saying some nice things about me. By the time I was 9 years sober, I was sponsoring 40 to 50 people, and I was talking all over the country, and I was dying inside. Because relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos were absolutely killing me, along with a couple other things. And I didn't know what was wrong. Because the character defects that were bothering me, what I would do, I would grab them by the collar, and I would use tools like prayers, steps, sponsors, meetings, outside counseling, inventories, and I would slam those character defects up against the wall, and I'd say, come here, God. Give me a little help and we'll get rid of this. And God never came and I didn't know what was wrong. Well, something happened and I'm going to sit down here in a minute, so I'm going to abbreviate this. Something happened in May of 1990 when I was 9 years sober that caused me to realize, and words are so important to me in sobriety. For instance, the word realize. I used to think to realize something was the same thing as to know something. Realize is the form of the word real. When I have realized something, that literally means it has become real inside me. The things I've known for 30 years that I haven't realized, that haven't become real inside me. Attitude, another one of my favorite words. I went through my whole life thinking my attitude was my thoughts and feelings about something, my mindset and the way I felt about something. And people kept telling me when I first got sober, change your attitude or you're going to die. Well, I'm trying to find all these inner buttons, change my attitude. I can't change anything. I think I got to die. So finally, Cherry sends me to a particular dictionary. And the first definition in that dictionary didn't have a thing to do with what I was thinking or feeling. It's a term from geometry and aviation. It is angle of approach. And that was like flipping a light switch on and off because my attitude went instantly from something totally beyond my control to something totally within my control. My attitude towards you doesn't have a thing in the world to do with what's going through my old crazy mind. It's the way I act towards you. So my attitude is truly under my control. But anyway, the word's important, and I began to realize in May of 1990 that I had missed the boat on step 6 and 7. As I said, I thought they were where, with God's help, I didn't know that, I went to work on me to make me into what I decided spiritual Don ought to be. I could have quoted the 7-step prayer to you backwards. But I didn't realize that it really means what it says. It doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. It only asks God to remove the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. And you see, my problem is I don't have a clue which ones they are. What I know for sure today is that a big portion of my usefulness to other people today, maybe the reason I'm here today, is because I suffered so long and deep into sobriety from character defects, but I somehow managed not to drink and somehow managed to keep stumbling in the right direction. And it got better. You see, my problem with perfection isn't what I thought it was. I thought it was my inability to attain it, and I certainly am unable to attain it. But that never matters. We never get that far. I'm unable to recognize perfection. If God gave me the power to become anything or anybody ought to be right now, I'd be like a blind dog in a butcher shop. I'd have no idea who and what I ought to become. And also, I thought 6 and 7 were where, with God's help, I went to work on me to make me into what I decided I ought to be. The 12 and 12, where it talks about 6 and 7, quotes another big old book that's not conference approved. It says, of myself I'm nothing, the Father does the work. And for 9 years, my brain edited that to read of myself, I'm not enough, and I have to have some help from God. And that's not what it says. It says, of myself, I'm nothing. The Father does the work. So the bottom line's simple. I can't effectively work on any of my character defects any more than I could effectively work on drinking and taking dope. The only shot I've got is to come to my God like a little child and lay the mess at his or her feet and say, Mom, Dad, I don't know where we are, how we got here, or where we're supposed to go, but I'm going to quit trying to figure out this pattern. See, without divine intervention, that's the way I want to approach everything. Let me figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. Problem, I'm 65 years old and haven't figured out a pattern right yet. Not one. But I still waste 40% of my waking hours trying to figure them out. My job's stitching. My job's stitching. There's a little spark of the divine inside us that knows only where to take the next stitch. We never know God's will in any time period except the instant. You know, we think it'll be God's will 5 seconds from now for me to still be up here going on. Truth is, in that next 5 seconds, any one of us could have a seizure or a heart attack. Fire alarm could go off. Airplane fly into the building. Wet drunk comes stumbling in, raising sand. Police come in looking for one of us that hadn't finished our amends. All sorts of things. All sorts of things could happen in the next 5 seconds to totally change what I'm convinced God's will be 5 seconds from now. And yet I won't waste all this time squirrel caging about God's will for tomorrow. You know, I want God to give me the strength on Saturday to handle Sunday. Ain't happening. And if I insist on it, I'm going to have a miserable Saturday. God will give me the strength to handle Saturday, and come Sunday, if Sunday gets here, based on my experience, God's probably going to be in the strength to handle Sunday, but he ain't going to give it to me on Saturday. If I insist on it on Saturday, I'm out of luck. I'm going to have a miserable day. But at any rate, connected with that, and I don't want to... Billy mentioned the fact that I do try really hard not to be controversial because it's so important to me. I have said many times in the last 20-odd years, if you have caught me arguing, somebody was paying me. I will not argue with you for nothing and make my belly hurt. I just simply will not, because God has truly delivered me from needing to be right in that regard. And I don't want to be controversial. I'm certainly not against doctors and counselors. And when my sponsees say, my doctor said I ought to take so-and-so, what should I do? I tell them, my God, man, I'm a lawyer, not a doctor. Do what your doctor says, for God's sake. You tell them you're an alcoholic? Okay, well, they do what they said. So I'm not criticizing, but I'm telling you this. I don't want any issues in my life. And here's why I don't want any issues in my life. In the years I've been sober, I figure I've heard probably about 20,000 issues enunciated. And I've never heard a single one that didn't fall squarely into one or more of the three parts of the fourth step. They involve resentment, fear, sexuality, or some combination of the three. But here's where why I really don't want issues. Of all those 20,000 or so that I've heard, I'm not aware of a single one that is permanently and satisfactorily resolved. So I don't want any issues because I don't have a clue what to do with an issue. I want character defects instead that I can drag to my God's feet and use 6 and 7 on and say, Dad and Mom, show me where to take this next stitch. Now, I've been stumbling in that direction since May of 1990, and I don't think there's been a single day in those 19 years that if you had asked me, Don, are you doing it well enough that it'll work, that I would have said I think might have today. In my opinion, I've stumbled and fallen so much, starting over sometimes 50 to 100 times a day, but it turns out my God's just fine with that. My God is just tickled to death with persistence. It turns out the only spiritual growth I'm capable of is the failing and getting up and stumbling another couple of steps and getting knocked over by self-will again, and I truly do that sometimes 50 or 100 times a day. And keep stumbling in that right direction. And here's the way it's working. By the way, something I didn't tell you, after I started getting on my knees in April of 81, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees since April of 81. Now, I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. I'm telling you that for a very different reason. In all those thousands of mornings and nights that I have gotten down there, at least half the time I hadn't really wanted to. There have been a whole bunch of times when I could have gotten a medical statement in writing that I didn't feel like getting down there. I've had a lot of surgery sober. It hurts to roll out of those hospital beds and get on your knees. Been a whole bunch of times when I could have gotten affidavits from lawyers and judges that I sure didn't have time to get down there. And I know, like my buddy Billy and this Billy and Al back there and Allison, I'm sure y'all have all reached a point where your life is never-ending serenity and there's just never a ripple. But unfortunately, it hasn't happened to me that way. I'm sure it has for old Ross and Linda. But unfortunately, I still wake up sometimes with the brain spinning. I still wake up scared and obsessed. I still wake up feeling like I'm cut off from you, like I'm cut off from God. Sometimes when I try to pray, my old brain spinning so much that I can't remember the last word I just tried to pray. It's obvious to me the words are bouncing off the walls and ceiling. It couldn't possibly be doing any good. But I've gotten down there every morning and every night. Something's worked every single day. And that's the second most important thing in my sobriety. The first most important thing in my sobriety is real simple. And that is today, just for today, with God's help and yours, I'm not going to drink or take dope if my butt falls off. Because, you see, all these things I'm talking about come to nothing if I bend the elbow. If I forget that powerless over alcohol does not mean powerless over my elbow. And ultimately, I cannot abdicate the responsibility for what I put in my body. Now, I get all sorts of help from you guys and certainly from my God. But you guys can't knock a drink out of my hand, and God won't knock a drink out of my hand. Ultimately, that's my responsibility. And I want to close by talking about just real quickly some of the things that have happened in my life since May of 1990, since I was 9 years sober. And I used to never talk about these, and then Billy and some other guys in Louisville said I had to. The miracles are just unbelievable. The banks that wouldn't let me have a checking account when I first came back to Louisville, no bank would take my money for a checking account. I'd go across the river in Indiana and exercise influence with a friend of ours in AA that owned stock in the bank to get somebody to take a checking account for me. Those same banks have given me unsecured credit lines, so they're embarrassing. Just absolutely embarrassing. The Bar Association that kicked me out so loudly and so embarrassingly and that I embarrassed the bar so bad has honored me until it really is truly an embarrassment. They made me the pro bono lawyer of the year. God's got a sense of humor on that because nobody thought about me in pro bono. That means doing good things for nothing. Before I got sober, they put me on the Citizens for Better Judges to interview people and pass on whether they were qualified to be judge, and they made me chair of that committee. They made me a master at end of court where I sat there with about 20 of the most powerful judges and lawyers in Kentucky and one little drunken criminal defense lawyer. And God has a wonderful sense of humor because about 3 or 4 years ago I was sitting in the barber chair and my cell phone rang and it was the president of the state bar. And he said, "Don, we have an opening on the ethics committee." The only people I was more afraid of than the State Bar Ethics Committee were the IRS and the FBI. They put me on the ethics hotline for criminal law. So if a lawyer in Kentucky has an ethical dilemma with criminal law, they call me. If I tell them what to do, if they do it, they're absolutely insulated from problems, even if I'm wrong. You know, the forgiveness of non-alcoholics for us. Would we be willing to do the right thing passes all understanding. Sharon and I celebrated 18 years married this past December. Now, nothing in this world is perfect, but I'll tell you what, Sharon and I don't argue. And I sponsor some guys that are psychologists, and I sponsor some that are counselors. And they tell me that it's not healthy to have a relationship where you don't argue. And I tell them that they are welcome to their healthy relationships. I'm just going to wallow in my illness. I'm doing just fine with that. Thank you. And there's a line of young lawyers that would stretch the length of this room that want to practice cases with me, not for money, but for the experience. And it's kind of like Billy and Mance's hero, Chuck Chamberlain, and the way in business, they're not sure what they want. They're not sure what they want. You sit down and tell them what you're doing. And they say, "No, that can't possibly be it. What's this guy really doing here?" And the trick is just this. When I go down there and try to win cases and look smart and outthink and outperform and outmaneuver and make money and cover my butt, I wind up in the snake pit every single time. But when I go down there and make it about the client and not about me, make it about everybody I run into, the judges, the other lawyers, but not me. When I try to love, comfort, and understand and do my job and try to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to, God's so much better lawyer than I am that it just creates magic. When I live the truth that the quiet, loving truth is so loud that in or out of a courtroom, you can't hear anything else. The quiet, loving truth, in or out of the courtroom, will drown out anything in this world. And that's all in the world it is. And I love every one of you, and I'm sorry I got wound up here, but let's call it a day, and thank you for having me, and God bless you.